from WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, sitting in for Terry Gross. Mike Nichols has been nominated for an Emmy for directing the HBO production of the off-Broadway play Wit. On today's Fresh Air, an interview with Mike Nichols. He also directed the films The Graduate, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and Primary Colors. And we remember one of the most respected historians of broadcasting, Eric Barno. He died last week at the age of 93. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation of writer Eudora Welty, and she reviews a new collection of short stories by another Southern writer, Bobby Ann Mason. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Ghost World. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. United Airlines and U.S. Airways have called off their planned merger in the face of opposition from the Justice Department. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Cancellation of the deal was announced hours after the Justice Department said it would go to court to block it. Attorney General John Ashcroft said in a statement that had the merger been allowed to proceed, quote, millions of consumers would have had little choice but to pay higher fares and accept lower quality air service. United tried to get out of the deal earlier this month, citing the likely government action and the declining economy, which made the financial aspect of the merger less attractive. United's parent, UAL, has agreed to pay U.S. Airways a $50 million termination fee. U.S. Airways has previously said it needs a merger in order to survive and is thought likely to shop for another partner. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
A judge in Florida has sentenced a teenager to 28 years in prison for shooting a teacher to death at a middle school last year. 14-year-old Nathaniel Brazil stood expressionless as the sentence was read, a sentence that was close to the minimum allowed for the crime. Brazil could have been sentenced to life in prison. His father said he was grateful for the judge's leniency.
It's a lot less than we would have expected. We'll live with it. Nate's going to have a good life. I'm in constant contact with him as far as sending him email stuff. He's going to have a good life. He'll be fine.
Brazil's son will not get out of prison until he's 41 years old, but the sister of the slain teacher says the sentence is an insult to her brother's memory. The House has voted to bar the Bush administration from weakening tough new standards for arsenic levels in drinking water that were set during former President Clinton's final days in office. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The vote in the Republican-controlled chamber was 218 to 189, with 19 Republicans joining all but six of the Democrats in support of the measure. It's aimed at tightening the current standards for arsenic in drinking water of 50 parts per billion to the standard set by the Clinton administration of just 10 parts per billion. The EPA put that new standard on hold in March for further study. New Jersey Democrat Frank Pallone warned that the EPA prefers less stringent standards.
We have statistics that show if you just go from 10 to 20 parts per billion, which maybe is what the EPA could ultimately do, that 3.5 million people would be impacted.
The vote ordering the Bush administration to stick with the Clinton-imposed standard was a rider on a spending bill still being debated. It's not clear whether the Senate would pass a similar measure. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Federal regulators have shut down a Chicago-area thrift institution that has been hit by huge losses on loans. The closure of Superior Bank will cost the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation an estimated $500 million. Wall Street today, the Dow was down 39 points in moderate trading. The Nasdaq was up 7. This is NPR News. Amtrak has announced plans to reduce its 2,900-person management staff through early retirement and incentives. Amtrak's president did not say, though, how many jobs will be affected. Diplomats from the United States and the European Union met with government officials and rebel leaders in Macedonia today on the eve of new peace talks there. Western nations have been pressing for a resumption of talks to head off a civil war. A key issue is the future status of the Albanian language in the small Balkan nation. Cincinnati's police chief says a white officer who shot and killed an armed black suspect early yesterday was acting in self-defense. Marianne Zalesnik of member station WNKU reports.
Chief Tom Stryker says the officer was shot at twice He then ordered the suspect to put down his weapon. When 21-year-old Ricky Moore pointed his gun again, the officer shot and killed him. Unlike a police shooting of an unarmed black man in April, which sparked 3 days of rioting, Cincinnati is quiet today. Black community leaders appear to be supporting the officer's actions. Since the April riots, violence has escalated in Cincinnati, with more than 70 shootings in the past 3 months. 7 people have died in the last 7 days. Cincinnati's mayor is calling on citizens to work with police to curb the violence. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Zalesnik in Cincinnati.
The Justice Department is arguing against a new trial for Oklahoma City bombing conspirator Terry Nichols. In legal briefs submitted to the U.S. Supreme Court today, the department said the belated discovery of documents in the case does not justify a new trial for Nichols because nothing in the materials proves his innocence. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, in for Terry Gross. Mike Nichols' HBO adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit has been nominated for several Emmys. The television version starred Emma Thompson, who co-wrote the adaptation with Nichols. Wit tells the story of a poetry professor who is diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer, which is terminal. The play follows her from the diagnosis through her high-dose experimental chemotherapy. The Emmy nominations for Wit include Best Film, Best Director, and Best Writing, all three categories in which Nichols has made a name for himself since the late 1950s. Before getting into film, Mike Nichols performed with Elaine May in the droll hipster comedy team Nichols and May. He made his first movie in 1966. It was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. Nichols went on to direct an impressive and diverse group of films: The Graduate, Catch-22, Carnal Knowledge, Silkwood, Working Girl, The Birdcage, and Primary Colors. Mike Nichols spoke with Terry Gross earlier this year.
Why did you get into directing? You started off as a performer, doing comedy. Why did you want to go behind the camera?
Well, I didn't want to stay a performer. I mean, it's not that it came up that much. I think that as a performer, I was something of a director. You know, there were two of us performing, and I was, you know, always bossing her around a little bit. But also, I never really was crazy about what performing brought out in me, more of the baby. And I feel like directing brings out the daddy in me to some extent. And I enjoy it more. I like it better.
In what way did acting bring about the baby in you?
Why did it? It's just something that happens to me. I just turn into a baby. You know, I say, shouldn't I have the other dressing room? And look, that light is out. And why don't we come first? And who's opening? And I just don't like the performer's baby impulses. And they come out plenty in me.
Whereas as the director, you have to be careful of all the other actors' egos and baby impulses, probably.
Well, that's right. Well, you're worrying about somebody else. You're thinking about somebody else, which is somehow more freeing and which I enjoy more. I don't like worrying, did they like me? Will they like me? I prefer worrying, will they like her? Will they like him? Will they like them?
You must have had your hands full with the first movie you directed, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, because starring in that was Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, who were two of, you know, perhaps the most, like, followed couple in the press and by the American public. And they had this tumultuous relationship, and the story is about people who prey on each other's neuroses and delusions. That must have been quite a job for a first-time director.
Well, I was lucky. They were very good friends of mine. Richard and I were very good friends. We'd been in the same alley. Our theaters were in the same alley when we were on Broadway in different shows. I was in Evening with Nichols and May, and he was in Camelot. And we'd become very close friends. And then I was just becoming a good friend of Elizabeth's. And I felt quite easy with them. And they were very sweet and wanted very much to make the movie as good as they could. And there was really only four of them, four actors, and they were wonderful to the other two actors, George Siegel and Sandy Dennis, and they were wonderful to me. And Richard had his difficult days, difficult for him first, but we waited for him in this way and that way, and that was the only problem that ever arose. I was extremely fond of them, and I thought they were doing very good work, and in a good way we enjoyed doing it. I mean, they would get down, they would get depressed. Sometimes she'd say she was tired of spitting at him, you know, and could we do something else for a while? She'd had 3 days of spitting at him. But by and large, they were a pleasure.
Let's just listen to a short scene from the film.
Stop it, Martha.
What you want?
I wouldn't go on with this if I were you.
I wouldn't, would you? Will you not?
You've already sprung a leak about you know what.
What? Why?
About the sprout, the little bugger, our son. If you start in on this other business, Martha, I warn you.
I stand warned.
Do we really have to go through all this?
So anyway, I married the SOB. I had it all planned out. First, he'd take over the history department. Then when Daddy retired, he'd take over the whole college, you know? That was the way it was supposed to be. Getting angry, baby, huh? That was the way it was supposed to be. All very simple. And Daddy thought it was a good idea, too, for a while. Until he started watching for a couple of years. Getting angrier? Until he watched for a couple of years and started thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all. That maybe Georgie boy didn't have the stuff. That maybe he didn't have it in him.
Stop it, Martha.
Like hell I will. You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great big fat flop.
Stop it, Martha.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary, not on an associate professor's salary.
That's a scene of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, directed by my guest, Mike Nichols. It was his first film. The first film that he directed. You know, it's funny, as part of Nichols and May, you dealt a lot with neuroses in relationships, but not on this level of kind of grand neurosis, you know, the grand theatrical version of neurosis.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of continuing a theme, but in a completely different level for you.
Well, yes, I think that's right. But, you know, when I saw the play of Virginia Woolf, I was really knocked out by it. I thought and still think that it's a great play, and I felt I knew a lot about it when it came up as a movie to direct because there's something about the way Albee went about it that was very familiar for somebody who'd gone to the University of Chicago and known certain people there who had difficult marriages and lived a certain kind of academic life. You know, the gag about academia is that there's, you know, why there's so much backbiting and viciousness in academia.
No, why?
Because the stakes are so low.
Right.
And that I had seen a certain amount of that at the university, and I really felt I understood it. And I think you're right. You know, Elaine May and I did neurotic couples, God knows, and here was one more.
Actually, maybe this would be a good time to hear an example of the kind of neurotic couple that you and Elaine May did. But this is not just neurotic, it's also neurotic with a lot of intellectual pretensions.
Yes, and this I know which one then.
This is a routine called Bach to Bach.
You know it very well.
Better than myself in some ways.
It's beautiful.
It has a fantastic peace.
Yes. It's serene. It has a kind of mathematical certainty that's almost sensual to me.
Yes, an order, a finality, finally.
Organization.
She plays it with just incredible clarity.
Yes, she does.
Yes. Yes. I remember I used to have to sneak in my room to hear it when I was a kid. You know, my family was your usual, you know, dull bourgeois family, of course. And there was really very little else for me.
Yeah. I guess my story is the same. My family was middle class,
yeah, sure,
ordinary.
Yeah.
And there was no relating. There was proximity, but yeah, no relating.
No, no, it can't be. The pressures are just incredible.
And of course I had a great many difficulties, which I've been trying to resolve.
Yes, and I think you are. I mean, I haven't known you that long, but...
Yeah.
You know, when you consider the... Well, the ambivalence of the woman's role today...
Oh, it's incredibly ambivalent. It's so hard to resolve. It's so hard to acknowledge the fact that aggressiveness need not be hostile.
That's right. Yes, no. Adler was no fool.
No. I always thought of him as a fool, but he said some good things.
Yes, no, I've reread him recently. There are insights there.
Yeah. Too many people think of Adler as a man who made mice neurotic.
No.
He was more.
Much more.
Much more.
Can you move over a little? I'm falling off the bed.
I'm sorry.
A great deal more.
Yes, yes, he was.
Mike Nichols, I don't think that's dated at all.
I don't know. Think that I agree with you. I don't think that things have changed. How could those things change between men and women?
How did you start doing comedy about neurosis, Jewish mother, psychotherapy, intellectual pretensions? It really wasn't the regular stuff of comedy at the time.
Well, I think it was the regular stuff of where Elaine and I found ourselves on the south side of Chicago at the University of Chicago. I think that we, to some extent, our comedy was formed by our audience by improvising in front of the audience in front of which we did improvise. That is to say, there were the University of Chicago at that time had a certain neurotic cast to it to some of the people, and it was preoccupied to some extent with Freud and with 100 great books and with certain literary references that the audience encouraged us to explore and make a little bit of fun of, so that by the time we got to New York, we were very surprised that everybody in New York thought it was so funny. Because one of the great things about Chicago, I don't know if you know Chicago, but it's a wonderful city, and it's not, unlike New York, it's not driven by fashions and anything. You don't hear a thundering herd going past your window all the time to the new restaurant or the latest play or anything. Chicago goes about its business, and it enjoys what it enjoys, and then it goes home. So it's a great place to grow and to learn something, because nobody makes a fuss. It's sort of like running with weights. But I think the answer to your question is that we were partly formed by that community.
I'm wondering if you and if Elaine May had experiences of your own with psychotherapy, because that's such a part of the humor.
Yes, at that time we did. I went to a therapist somewhere around there in Chicago, and I believe she did. And we... In fact, I remember now that I met a girl who told me that this young doctor had made a play for her, and she turned him down. And it turned out to be my doctor. And it became a sort of campus story that I said, well, come on, let's go home. And she said, no, I couldn't possibly. I said, why? She said, because it would be, you know... the gold-plated proof. And I said, so do me a favor. And actually she did. And then I was able to tell my doctor when he came back from his vacation that girl that had turned him down had not turned me down. But I loved it, of course. But we didn't get any further in my therapy.
Mike Nichols speaking with Terry Gross. His HBO adaptation of the play Wit has been nominated for several Emmy Awards, We'll continue in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with director Mike Nichols. They were discussing his work in the comedy team of Nichols and May.
In the sketch that we just heard, both you and Elaine May complain about coming from the usual dull bourgeois family, you know, the middle class kind of family. You weren't from the usual dull bourgeois family. I mean, your family had made quite attractive to get here. You were born in Berlin. You and your brother, when you were children, had to travel alone across the ocean to come here after Hitler's rise to power. Your father had already come here. And your mother, I think, was sick and had to stay behind. That's a pretty scary journey for a couple of boys to make on their own.
Well, it is, unless you're the little boy. You know, kids sort of accept whatever happens. For us, it was very exciting, a gigantic ship and nobody to tell us what to do. And sort of a nice, there was a stewardess meant to look after us who let us play or do, I don't know, I don't even remember what we did, but we got to do what we wanted. It wasn't perceptibly scary to us, but you're absolutely right, it wasn't any bourgeois existence either. We weren't in any way middle class, Elaine or I. We were terribly poor, my family, when we got here, and when we'd been here for a while. My father eventually set up his practice and did fine, but you could never have called us, you know, a middle-class family, nor Elaine's family, who were Jewish actors who traveled all over, mostly South America, that we were really not talking about ourselves when we were making those jokes.
You're talking about the people who you knew in Chicago.
Right. And sort of the way that people had begun to talk about being middle class, that it was something you were always a little ashamed of.
It seemed a little oppressive.
Oppressive, and you wanted to be special. You wanted to be a worker, a sufferer, somebody who had political aspirations, but middle class, bourgeois. I mean, look at the word bourgeois itself. It started out meaning simply middle class and then ended up pejorative as it came into our language from French.
How old were you when you came to the States?
7.
So you were 7, speaking, I think, no English.
No, not for the first couple of weeks. But, you know, again, kids learn it very, very fast. In a couple of weeks, I was speaking English in school.
Uh-huh. Because you seem like such a verbal person. I mean, you operate in such a verbal universe, and you've had to be so quick verbally all your life. Must have been hard, even if just for that early period when you couldn't communicate through language.
I actually remember not knowing certain words in English, but it went so fast, you know, that it was over in a minute, as it were. And I think I've always thought that sort of immigrant's ear, that the extra ear that tells you what else is happening aside from what people are saying, is a very useful thing. And it's a very interesting thing to have, because you do hear, sometimes you hear things you wish you didn't, but sometimes, mostly you hear very interesting and sometimes useful things. And I recognize it in other immigrants. You know, somebody like Dr. Kissinger, who was such a great negotiator, I could assume that immigrant's ear let him hear things that they weren't saying and let him... He had a special talent, which was to hear what you were thinking and give it back to you so that you would think that you were just like him. And then, I assume, he would begin to negotiate. And I think all that has to do with being the little kid listening very hard for what's really happening in this new place.
When you were doing your comedy improvisations, needless to say, you were improvising a lot. I'm wondering how sympathetic you are to improvising as a director. In Wit, for instance, did you encourage Emma Thompson or any of the other characters to improvise, or do you think that theater and movies aren't really the place for that?
I think that they are the place for it under certain circumstances. That is, I've always assumed that if you have a very good writer, as we did in Wit, as I have had in the theater and in movies, you've got to assume that a writer, you know, thinking about a line for somewhere between 6 months and 5 years is going to do better than an actor making it up on the spot, including a feeling of spontaneity. You know, that's what theater and film writing is about. On the other hand, sometimes when there are things missing that you can only improvise, I have scenes that are entirely improvised in most of my pictures, and they're not very wordy. You know, I think there's one in Working Girl where Harrison Ford and Melanie Griffith have breakfast in this tiny kitchen together, and it's not great literature, but you can tell that they love each other. And improvisation is very good for certain things like that and for certain moments. But by and large, when you've got a very good writer, I say trust him.
So in that scene in Working Girl, what happened in terms of the dialogue that reveals that they are now in love?
Well, it had more to do with drinking from each other's coffee cups and mm-hmm. taking a bite of each other's English muffin and something that the writer improvised, in fact, Kevin Wade, on the spot, which is that he gave her lunchbox to go to work for the first day with, and had her pencils and had her sandwich. And it was about people loving each other, but the words were nothing. They were unimportant.
Mike Nichols speaking with Terry Gross. His HBO adaptation of the play Wit has been nominated for several Emmy Awards. We'll hear the rest of their conversation in the second half of today's show. I'm Peter Clowney, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with director Mike Nichols. Also, we remember one of the most respected historians of broadcasting, Eric Barnow. He died last week. Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation of writer Eudora Welty, and she reviews Bobby Ann Mason's new collection of short stories. And Henry Sheehan reviews the new film, Ghost World. This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with director Mike Nichols. His movies include Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Catch-22, The Graduate, Working Girl, and Primary Colors. Nichols' adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit for HBO has been nominated for several Emmys. The adaptation stars Emma Thompson as a professor of 17th century poetry who has been diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer and is receiving experimental high-dose chemotherapy.
You mentioned that you lost your mother to cancer. How long ago was that?
That was in 1976.
Did any of the ways in which she behaved when she was sick surprise you? Did anything seem out of character or so crystallize what her essence was?
Absolutely. She was a person who didn't suffer things easily and did tend to complain. And we were all very touched and impressed by and surprised by the facts in the last year when she certainly knew that she was going to die, that she was extremely courageous and changed in that respect absolutely. And indeed had her courage to hold to her during that toughest year. And we were very proud of her, and we all got very close to her through her courage.
How much did she confide in you about what she was feeling, both physically through the cancer, but also feeling in terms of facing imminent death? Did she want to protect you from all of that, or did she talk with you openly about it?
Well, both, really. That is to say, I mean, my brother and I were grown up, and I think I said 76 when I met 86.
That's much more recent, yeah.
Yeah. She implied certain things, but she kept most of it to herself. In fact, I think that what she found was a kind of reserve about those things, and a kind of private place. And the more she, who had been such a complainer, the more reserved she was and the less she complained, of course, the more we all crowded around and worried about her and tried to take care of her and show that we loved her. And so the last year was extremely important for everyone in the family.
Did you feel that watching her death change your feelings at all about death? Did it make you any more or less afraid of it, or make you wonder any more about what happens after death? You know, if you became more of a nothing happens after death, or more religious and wondering about what happens after death?
I've never gotten very far with that question. I've just always assumed that everything just sort of stops. You know, I'm not one of the people who imagines heaven and hell and so forth. And I'm more concerned with what the actual dying is like, and do you bring some courage to it, and can you say goodbye to people properly, and can you accept it and be glad of your life? I think we all do a kind of checking. What if it happened now? What if it happened tomorrow? Have I gotten enough done? Have I been okay? Have I been an okay person? All that kind of stock taking. But I don't go on to afterward. I've found that having children and children that I'm close to has made a real difference. In some weird way, you do feel that you're going to go on. They're going to carry on something for you. And my children's step-grandfather, my stepfather, died last year. And they've been very concerned that he not be forgotten, you know, and worried that nobody's talked or thought about him for a while now. Let's do that. They don't want him forgotten. And I agree with them. You know, it's nice when there's somebody around who remembers you.
You're obviously a very verbal person and a fine writer. When your mother was dying or when your close friend was dying, did you feel like you had the words to say what you really wanted to say?
Yes, I don't think it's a time for a lot of words. I think it's time to be there. It's all about being there. You know, another friend of mine died some years ago and never spoke of it, and the doctor asked her on the last night, do you want to talk about it? And she said, my only chance is not to talk about it. And I completely understand that. When you're there, and it's somebody's last day, hour, whatever, it's not about what anybody says at all. I think so much of real life is not about what anybody says. It's about what we do, and in the sense of somebody who's losing their life, it's about being there.
Of course, in theater, it has to be in part about what's being said. Like wit, for instance, is well, it's all monologue and dialogue. Not all, but I mean, it's so much about what's being said.
Yes, but even in wit, you know, which is in which things are said so beautifully and what's the word I want? Strictly. Towards the end, there isn't that much.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. It's less and less about formulations and syllogisms because they're for the living.
Well, Mike Nichols, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Mike Nichols spoke earlier this year with Terry Gross. His HBO adaptation of the play Wit has been nominated for several Emmys. Right now, Nichols is directing a new production of the Chekhov play The Seagull, starring, among others, John Goodman, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Kevin Kline, Meryl Streep, and Christopher Walken. The Seagull begins previews this week as part of the Shakespeare in the Park series in New York. It opens officially next month. Literary legend Eudora Welty died on Monday at the age of 92. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation and a look forward.
Eudora Welty belonged to that grand tradition of the demure lady writer with a gimlet eye. It's a lineage that extends from Jane Austen through Emily Dickinson and Harriet Beecher Stowe into the 20th century with, among others, Agatha Christie, Barbara Pym, Anita Bruckner, and Welty herself. By most accounts, all these women were or are shy, deferential, wallflower types. But on paper, they're elegantly sarcastic, irreverent, and strangely calm about recording eruptions of evil that would make a strong man tremble. Like Agatha Christie in particular, Eudora Welty seems to have cultivated a personal dullness so that the curious world would move on by and leave her alone to write. But critics were always trying to pry into the sources of her rueful, often dark vision. For instance, a biography of Welty I reviewed a few years ago dwelt a lot on her appearance. Welty was undeniably homely, and her male biographer made much of that fact, patronizingly speculating that to be a plain girl in the old South of Welty's youth was a tragedy that forever marked her soul. Maybe, but being no beauty certainly didn't put a crimp in the ego or sexual style of another Southern woman of roughly the same generation, Lillian Hellman. Another critic, the otherwise wonderful feminist literary scholar Carolyn Heilbrun, really ripped into Welty in her best-selling popular study of women's biographies and autobiographies, Writing a Woman's Life. Heilbrun thought that Welty's 1984 autobiography, One Writer's Beginnings, was dishonest because it discreetly skated over whatever dysfunction or dirt existed in her charmed Mississippi childhood. Nostalgia, pronounces Heilbrun, particularly for childhood, is likely to be a mask for unrecognized anger. For years, I religiously quoted that sentence to my students in the women's autobiography course I teach, and we all dutifully read Welty's bittersweet memoir, which my students always loved, sifting through paragraphs for traces of rage. We always came up empty. And then one semester, I threw out Heilbrunn's criticism and just decided that, in some rare people, a sharp intelligence can coexist with happiness and placidity of character. Welty herself advised readers not to look for the origins of her complex, unflappable literary vision in her life. In the last sentence of One Writer's Beginnings, she says, "I am a writer who came of a sheltered life. A sheltered life can be a daring life as well, for all serious daring starts from within." My favorite Welty story, and I've by no means read them all, is the classic Why I Live at the P.O. That's the one where a hilariously narcissistic young female narrator, who's the postmistress of a tiny southern town, tries to justify why she's moved out on her mean and madcap family. There's fodder for a decade's worth of therapy compressed in the opening paragraph of that story, and I thought about reading it aloud here as a tribute to Welty's genius, but I just don't have the right accent. I know it's considered reductive to talk about Welty as a southern writer, but come on. The voice of Welty's marvelous stories is as rich as the Mississippi mud. Native New Yorkers like me can only gratefully wallow in it with our mouths shut. When I heard the news that Eudora Welty died, I was deep into a new short story collection by one of Welty's inheritors, Bobby Ann Mason, another of the South's peculiar daughters. Mason's collection, Zigzagging Down a Wild Trail, is filled with funny and regretful stories about Southerners at home and far away, in London, Saudi Arabia, California. In addition to being more far-flung, Mason's characters are raunchier than Welty's, but they often share the same shrewd, skewed take on life. Mason's characters are mostly just getting by, giving themselves the occasional kick with booze or bus trips to the casino or stints in the National Guard. In one of the most compelling stories, called Tunica, a young woman named Liz tries to cut all ties with her estranged husband, a drug dealer, but he's just too seductive. Mason writes, "Liz's friends frequently instructed her on what she ought to do, like file a restraining order against her husband, sign up for kickboxing, join some support group or other. But Liz stubbornly resisted. Everybody had an answer and a 7-step program. There were more answers than questions anymore, she believed. With white gloves on or off, reveling in the questions, the sheer strangeness of all that is unknowable, is a pleasure the intrepid Welty and the impudent Mason both share. Keats would have called it negative capability. Welty merely would have smiled."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Zigzagging Down a Wild Trail by Bobby Ann Mason. Coming up, we remember broadcast historian Eric Barno. This is Fresh Air. Most students of broadcasting have learned about its past from a 3-volume history written by Eric Barno. Barno died last week at the age of 93. Barno also edited the International Encyclopedia of Communications, and he founded the Radio Television Film Department at Columbia University. Eric Barno was born in 1908, before the days of broadcasting. In 1996, Terry Gross asked him to remember his first radio job. He was hired in 1931 by an advertising agency to produce a network radio show sponsored by the agency's client, Camel Cigarettes. The Camel Quarter Hour was broadcast on the CBS radio network from 7:45 Eastern Time, 6 nights a week.
It was a 15-minute show, and it began with Morton Downey singing Carolina Moon, Keep Shining, Shining on the One That Waits for Me. And that faded down, and then there was an announcement that this was the Camel Quarter Hour. And he was identified somewhere as the Camel Minstrel. And then he sang another number. And then that was followed by the essential part of the program, which was Tony Wands, who had developed an enormous audience reading poems at 9 in the morning. And he had become a kind of soulmate to millions of women. They wrote him letters and so on. And the whole idea of the program was, if we can get Tony against the same kind of lush music to do a commercial about Camel cigarettes, it'll bring a lot of women into the fold. So this was our idea, to double the market by getting women to smoke.
Do you remember what the songs to advertise Camel were like? Did he sing jingles, or were they more like romantic ballads about smoking cigarettes?
Well, first of all, it was sweet music. And then Tony Wands always began his programs with, "Are you listening?" He spoke very quietly, very close to the microphone. And he would read a poem in the middle of the program, and then at the beginning and the end, over the same kind of music, he would say things like this, that cigarettes, they're as fresh as the dew that dawn spills on a field of clover. And, the language is all like that. And they had just come out with a cellophane-wrapped package, which ensured freshness. And at that time, Lucky Strike had a program in which the commercials were delivered by somebody who was referred to as Thundering Thorgenson. He shouted at you. And this was thought to be a good strategy against Thundering Thorgenson, which was whispering Tony Wands.
When you started working in radio, what did you like most about radio, and what did you think was the most unsatisfactory part about it? In other words, what were some of the best and worst programs that you remember?
I remember, the only thing I remember is that I did not own a radio, and I had never thought of buying one. And after I was hired, I went and bought one and listened to it all weekend so that I could come in on Monday morning full of ideas. And so I had no worst or best programs in mind. I just didn't listen to radio at all.
What did you think of it when you started listening?
I was intrigued and amazed by it. The agency representative took me around to various programs that they represented. So the very first program that I saw then, and I didn't criticize it as something absurd, but it was Les Reese and Artie Dunn, two people who sang Cheek by Jowl at a piano in close harmony. And their program began, the Chiclets song, when you're feeling kind of blue, when you wonder what to do, chew Chiclets and cheer up. When you've lost your appetite, here's the way to set it right. Chew Chiclets and cheer up. There's a sweet and minty flavor in each handy yellow box. And at that point, it would fade down for an announcer who would step in and say something else, and then they would introduce the songs. And that was the way that program went.
In the early days of radio, was absolutely everything scripted? Say you and I were having a little interview in the early 1930s. Would our lines be written for us?
No, but this is what would happen. And I was asked to, I was interviewed over NBC at this time, and I've forgotten the lady who interviewed me, but the procedure was that the interview was done away from the studio, and a transcript was made, and then the whole thing was written. You could not broadcast an interview live. That was the whole idea. And then we would get a script, and it would be edited for policy, to see if there's anything wrong. Anybody had said that was terrible and frightening, and so they would edit it down, and then we came into the studio and we read our interview, and that's the way all interviews were done up to a certain time.
Now that explains something. I, for instance, have some radio transcriptions of George Gershwin on the air.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he's playing himself. It sounds like he's reading the part George Gershwin. It sounds very scripted.
I'm sure, absolutely, yeah. They were so afraid that somebody would say something that would somehow change the course of history. There were, for instance, an opera singer who was allowed to go on the air, and the agency, the station had been warned against her because she does surprising things. But she said she only wanted to read some nursery rhymes. So they felt reassured, and she did read some nursery rhymes. And one of them was, There was an old woman who lived in a shoe. She had so many children because she didn't know what to do. And this caused an absolute catastrophe at the network, I mean, the station. They had, you know, she was persona non grata from then on. So that's the kind of thing that they were afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing had been sold before radio began to get so commercial. It had been sold as this enormous educational opportunity. I mean, the rhetoric in the early 20s about what radio would do and how it would change the world and how this was the opportunity for democracy to really prove itself.
Boy, does that sound familiar.
Oh, yes.
Every time a new medium comes along, we fool ourselves into thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
About how we will become perfected.
Yeah, the predictions of 1922, I think I called it the euphoria of 1922 in the history book I did, was just marvelous. There was even a former Secretary of the Navy who said, nobody is now afraid that the Japanese will ever bomb up Pacific possessions because radio makes secrecy impossible.
Wow. So tell me, every time you hear predictions about how cable will change our lives or digital or the Internet, the World Wide Web, do you go, oh, sure, I've heard this before?
I do. I don't even have to tell myself that anymore. Yes. Yes, I have a built-in resistance to it.
Eric Barno speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. He died last week at the age of 93. Barno wrote the classic three-volume History of Broadcasting in the United States. Coming up, a review of the film Ghost World. This is Fresh Air. Ghost World is the first feature film directed by Terry Zwigoff, whose documentary Crumb was about the cartoonist R. Crumb. Zwigoff based Ghost World, a story about alienated teens, on the graphic novel by Daniel Clowes. Zwigoff and Clowes co-wrote the screenplay. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Ghost World is one of the best films of this sorry, sorry summer. And like its fellow independent Our Song, it's about teenage girls, although white and middle class, rather than black or Latina and poor. Teenage girls are great subjects for movies because they are simultaneously such mistresses of social artifice and exponents of intimacy. Towards the world, they adopt a posture that modulates between indifference and ridicule, attitudes so instinctively honed that they can destroy a male ego with a whisper and a giggle. But alone together, behind a closed bedroom door, all pretense towards cool is abandoned with an honesty before which teenage boys can only cower. Ghost World is about a girl who gets those two poles of behavior all mixed up. Terry Zwigoff's feature is based on a graphic novel series by Daniel Clowes, and both men worked on the screenplay. Their heroine is played by Thora Birch, the young actress from American Beauty, who shows up here with her devastating sulk perfectly preserved. Birch's Enid, along with her best friend Rebecca, played by Scarlett Johansson, have just graduated from high school as the two most angrily alienated kids in their class. At least Enid believes she graduated. As it turns out, she has to take a summer art class to get enough credits for her diploma. This puts a crimp in the girls' plans to get jobs and share an apartment, but Enid seems to have gotten cold feet about it anyway. She has always despised conformity, and getting a job is too much like growing up, code for selling out. For Rebecca, not getting a job is too much like copping out. The two girls are drifting apart at just the moment they expected to be closest together. Here, the two unknowingly experience that rift when Enid visits Rebecca at her job at a chain coffee shop.
I have a decaf mocha to go.
Mm-hmm. One decaf mocha?
Decaf mocha.
Can I get you?
No, I do not want a biscotti with that.
God. Some people are okay, but mostly I just feel like poisoning everybody.
Well, at least the wheelchair guy is entertaining.
He doesn't even need that wheelchair. He's just totally lazy.
That rules.
No, it really doesn't. You'll see. You get totally sick of all the creeps and losers and weirdos.
But those are our people.
Yeah, well. So when are you gonna get a job?
I'm working on it. Got a few leads. You know, don't worry about it. I'll get a job next week.
Klaus and Zweigoff show unusual empathy for alienated teenage girls in general, and with their prized creation, Enid, in particular. The cartoonist and the documenter of a cartoonist can't help projecting an idealized version of themselves into the movie. Enid takes up a friendship with and comes close to a strange romance with a middle-aged record collector named Seymour. Played by Steve Buscemi in one of the gifted actor's best performances, Seymour is an R. Crumb-like recluse who at first is the victim of one of Enid's cruel practical jokes. But Enid finds Seymour's determination to go his own eccentric way admirable, and soon she's gone from unknown tormentor to very nearly a muse. Zweigoff and Klaus haven't just projected themselves into the movie. They've come up with a mirror figure, too, an art teacher played by Ileana Douglas, who is for self-expression as long as the student's expression coincides with hers. She seems to represent all that's miserably highfalutin to the two cartoon lovers. There are times when Enid threatens to morph from a human being into a ping-pong ball hurtling between Seymour and the teacher, but the filmmakers manage to pull back from the programmatic brink. And Birch is such an intractable embodiment of adolescent pain, resentment, and hope that Enid has a life that's as free from her creators as it turns out to be from her teacher.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Megan Howell, and Jessica Chu. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Peter Clowney.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Dell Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of The Greatest Generation Speaks, Letters and Reflections by Tom Brokaw, available in a paperback edition, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how people in Israel and the occupied territories are dealing with the stress and anxiety of renewed violence in the Middle East. We talk with a Palestinian psychiatrist living in Gaza and an Israeli psychiatrist in Tel Aviv. Join us for the next Fresh Air.